the way I'm able to do what I do is to talk to current people in these worlds who are willing to talk to me, and then former people who are willing to talk to me. And then I always agree to come back to them with the manuscript. And what's invariably happened over the years is people have said, well, Brad, we told you point A and we told you point C, which are not classified. We don't mind that those are out there, but point B in your book has got to come out. I'm like, well, you guys didn't tell me. They're like, it doesn't matter. What you put in point B can't be there, and it's got to be out. And so I never want to poison my well of sources. So I always remove it or adapt it to the point where they're like, okay, that's good.
I'm David Preece, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 21st, 2021. Last week, for the Michael V. Hayden Center for Intelligence, Policy, and International Security at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government, I moderated a virtual event called Spy Writing in the Real World. It featured three authors of espionage fiction, two with previous experience working inside the U.S. intelligence community. Brad Thor, the number one New York Times bestselling author of 21 thrillers, most featuring the weathered hero Scott Harbath. Karen Cleveland, a former CIA analyst and New York Times bestselling author of Need to Know and Keep You Close. And award-winning author and former NSA and CIA officer Alma Katsu, who'd written five novels prior to her first new spy novel, Red Widow. We talked about the spy thriller genre, their challenges within it, their research, and, for Karen and Alma, their experience with pre-publication classification review. Our conversation has been edited for length and for clarity. It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 21st, Spy Writing in the Real World. Brad, let me start with you by asking, you know what, before we get into the stories and the spies, actually, I want to mention something else here. Scott Harbath, as a character, is very fond of saying he doesn't believe in coincidences. If you notice a coincidence, there might be something else going on that's part of somebody else's op around you. You had something that may or may not have been a coincidence a few years ago that involves our namesake. Do you want to tell everybody how it is you happened to bump into General Mike Hayden?
I was in New York having dinner at a fabulous Greek restaurant called Malivos, with my agent, and I look over, and a couple of tables back, there is Mandy Patinkin and General Hayden having dinner. And it was late in the evening. We were some of the last people in the restaurant. I waited until they had finished, and I walked up to the table, and I said, "Gentlemen, I'm so sorry to interrupt your desserts, but boy, would I love a photograph." And Mandy Patinkin right away thought I was talking to him. And Mandy Patinkin stands up and says, "Oh, I'd be honored." And I said, "Well, thank you. You just hit this button right here." And I handed Mandy my phone. And he looked at me and I said, "I want a picture with the real CIA director, not the guy from the Homeland show." And so I stood next to General Hayden and I got a photo taken with him, and it's one of the loveliest things I have in my office. And then we took one with Mandy because we didn't want to hurt his feelings. But I got to imagine it was kind of fun for General Hayden to have somebody recognize him and want a photo with him as opposed to Mandy. So that was a real neat thing for me because I've been a fan of the generals for a long time.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us tonight and being a part of this. Let me start out just by asking you a general question. You have almost an encyclopedic knowledge of a range of things, from weaponry, firearms, to exotic geography. And I'm wondering how it is you decided to write about thriller action. Why is it you decided to place a character inside or around United States national security apparatus? Why did you choose the spy thriller genre in the first place?
Well, the big reason is, and I wish I had come up with this line, but it's Stephen King's line. He said, one of the worst pieces of advice people get is to write what they know. You should write what you love to read because that's where your passion is. And if you've read a lot in a particular genre, you've developed a mini PhD. Now, I'm the son of a United States Marine. The Marine Corps was my dad's ticket out of the South Side of Chicago. It got him the GI Bill and a college education. And my dad believed and passed on to us that there is no American dream without those willing to protect it. So I've always been enamored with our warrior class, whether these be people in the military, law enforcement, or the intelligence community. And I grew up reading a lot of the authors that were talked about at the beginning of the program, Freddie Forsyth, John le Carré, Trevanian didn't get mentioned, Trevanian, another great, great author. And this stuff really got me excited. So when I sat down to write my first novel, it was just natural for me to want to write a thriller within the intelligence world.
Karen, tell us a little bit about why you decided to step away from your role as an analyst inside the CIA and devote your time and energy to writing these spy novels for us.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for having me here. And yeah, you know, when I wrote my first book, I decided to write about a CIA analyst because I was a CIA analyst. It was a world that I knew, and it was a world I was part of at the time. I was still working for the CIA at the time. I was actually on maternity leave with my middle child. And, you know, I love spy thrillers. I also really like domestic suspense and psychological thrillers. And I tried to sort of bring all of that into Need to Know and just write the sort of book that I would like to read.
Alma, you could have stuck with the, what do you call it, supernatural horror genre, writing about all kinds of historical events that actually had a supernatural angle to them. But instead, you decided to go Red Widow. Why?
Well, some people might think I'm coming at this completely backwards. It's true. I mean, Red Widow was my sixth novel, and the previous five have all had like some historical fiction element to them with either horror or, you know, a supernatural twist. But, you know, I kept thinking I should be able to write a spy novel, right? I had this whole career in intelligence and I can write. You know, I should be able to put the two together. But it wasn't until my editor at Putnam, Sally Kim, who's just an amazing woman, really encouraged me to give it a try. And I knew there were things by that point, you know, I'd been writing 10 years and had over 30 years in intelligence. And I knew there were things that I wanted to see in a spy novel that I wasn't seeing in most spy novels up till now. You know, it's a very rich, challenging career. There's a lot of aspects to it that you don't know about unless you're in it and you've lived it. And then also there was the aspect of knowing how gutting it is when you find out that you maybe have been working with a traitor, that somebody you know has been a traitor to the country. And I just wanted to bring that sort of deep personal experience to that story. And so, yeah, I got the chance to do it all in Red Widow.
Yeah. Brad, you have the luxury and the burden, and I think there is a little bit of both, right, of writing about intelligence without having been an employee of an intelligence operation. Tell us about your research. You write compellingly about everything from SEER, the survival, evasion, resistance, escape. To places like Murmansk and Kaliningrad, Russia, which you probably didn't get a chance to visit in recent years. And you write about it compellingly. How is that easier when you're not burdened by a former employment status with an intelligence agency? And what are the trade-offs in that?
So it's interesting. First of all, I buy a lot of pitchers of beer and a lot of steak dinners. I could not do what I do without the generosity of people who have served, whether it's in the special operations community, in the intel community. Those are people that I go to. So like real estate has three things that are important: location, location, location. Writing espionage fiction has three things that are really important: entertainment, entertainment, entertainment. I got savaged by one of your colleagues, John Cypher, who was really upset that I did something that John didn't think I should have done in one of the books. And I'm not writing stuff to be used at Camp Perry to teach people how to be better intelligence officers. My first and foremost goal is to entertain people and get them turning those pages. And John had a legitimate beef. I'm not knocking John. It was a legit beef. So the way I'm able to do what I do is to talk to current people in these worlds who are willing to talk to me, and then former people who are willing to talk to me. And then I always agree to come back to them with the manuscript. And what's invariably happened over the years is people have said, well, Brad, we told you point A and we told you point C, which are not classified. We don't mind that those are out there, but point B in your book has got to come out. I'm like, well, you guys didn't tell me. They're like, it doesn't matter. What you put in point B can't be there, and it's got to be out. And so I never want to poison my well of sources. So I always remove it or adapt it to the point where they're like, okay, that's good. So for me, if I can't go and visit a place like Kaliningrad, where I actually talked to an intelligence officer who had been in Kaliningrad, who told me about, you know, you can't even use a satellite phone because the minute you fire it up, blah, 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 blah. I want to talk to people, if I can't go, people who have operated there, particularly intelligence operatives or special operations personnel who were paid and whose careers in their assignments and sometimes even their lives depended on noticing the details, because they give me great color commentary. I wanted to do something on the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I asked a former military operative for help. And this was the first time we'd ever worked together. And I said, hey, you know, I need some details. And this guy said, what do you mean by details? And I said, I don't know. What are the bicycles like there? And the guy goes, oh my gosh, I got to tell you, everybody drives the same bike and they're black and they're called a Mamba because the tires leave trails in the dusty streets that look like a Mamba snake has been through there. I put that in my book, Code of Conduct, and I heard from more people that have been in that part of the world that said, only if you had been here could you have known that, Thor. So I can't believe you traveled here to stay. So that's kind of how the research goes, but it's only through the grace and generosity of people who have been in these worlds and been to these places that are willing to work with me that I'm able to get those things right. So I'm just very fortunate to have the network that I do.
Thanks. And while you routinely take your readers around the world, sometimes in a matter of chapter to chapter, Karen, your novels are more intensely personal. You take readers inside those dark places in their own mind, sometimes invading the reader's mind with some very sensitive psychological issues involving personal relationships as they intersect with the intelligence business. But you have really realistic details about operations in the CIA and the FBI as the settings in your two novels so far. Describe the process you used both to bring that level of truth to the fiction while also protecting no kidding classified information that you happened to know.
Yeah, so, you know, I think I've tried to draw on personal experiences. My first and my third book are CIA focused, and my second book is sort of FBI focused, and I did work on rotation to the FBI for a while. So I did try to take what I knew about those careers from sort of working within them and apply them to my books. And also, yeah, you know, the three novels are all sort of DC based. So I also kind of took what I knew just sort of living and working in the DC area for many years and applied that to the books. But the books are sort of a little more personal, like you say. And, you know, I think I did sort of try to take that kind of adage, write what you know, to heart. And in my first book, Need to Know, the protagonist is a CIA analyst, and she's also a mom of young kids. And she's sort of struggling to find that balance between her work life and her home life. And when I wrote the book, you know, I was in a similar position in my life with young kids at home and kind of struggling to find that balance in my own life. So while I didn't sort of face any sort of predicament like she did in the novel, fortunately, I was able to sort of put myself in her shoes just based on those similarities. And that did sort of help me.
For the material you had, especially in your first book, that did involve anything from office politics to counterintelligence practices, did you go through a clearance process to make sure you weren't revealing any secrets inadvertently?
I did have to submit all of my writing to the Publications Review Board, the CIA Publications Review Board, which is now, I guess, the Pre-Publication Classification Review Board. But that is sort of a lifelong agreement that any, you know, CIA officer signs up for, is to always submit your writing to the board. And it's just a, you know, another check to make sure that there is nothing classified in the writing. You know, it is nice to have that check, I think, because, you know, I joined the CIA to help make our country a safer place. And, you know, the last thing I would want to do is sort of accidentally disclose anything classified. So I think it is a nice check to have.
Right on. Alma, what about you? For your previous works, your reimaginings of the sinking of the Titanic or the Donner Party, you had no need to clear this for classified information unless there's something about those that we really don't know. But Red Widow, wow, it is a real remarkable glimpse into one of the CIA's real offices, Russia House. What was your clearance process like?
Surprisingly smooth. I mean, I'm sure Karen felt the same way, but you kind of hold your breath when you submit it, hoping that, you know, you're pretty sure you didn't put anything classified in there, but the things they're trying to protect are sources and methods. And, you know, I don't know how it was for Karen, but the entire time I was writing it, you know, that was going through the back of my mind. You know, what could I say that wouldn't stray anywhere near, you know, classified information? But still, you're not sure. And you send it in and you kind of keep your fingers crossed. And I was ready for them to come back and say, well, we want you to dial this back or that back. They did not ask for one change. I was just so relieved.
Did you feel like I did when you submit a book and it comes back with few or no changes? You wonder, am I doing this wrong? Am I drawing the line here and it actually should have included more?
You know, that's a great point. And I can't imagine how nerve-wracking it must be for nonfiction, because you have to stay close to the truth. Yeah, I have to say it probably did cross my mind a little bit, but also because even though this is my first spy novel that's been published, for the 10 years when I was writing my first novel, I did try spy novels and I would send them through the PRB. Oh. And so I've seen that it can be a bit of a pendulum swing depending on what's going on in the world. Sometimes maybe they're a little tighter and other times they're a little looser. So I'm sure I'm going to have my time in the barrel. if not this book, maybe the next book.
Yeah. That's a good segue back to you, Brad, talking about what's going on in the world, because you have this uncanny ability, which is almost disturbing, to have plots in your novels that obviously you write a year in advance and then go through the process of developing. Your book coming out is already written. You're not changing it. And yet, almost certainly, something's going to happen in the next few months that echoes one of your plot points. How is it that you go about coming up with these dastardly plans that the bad guys try almost every single novel and not worry that you're actually giving some real-life bad guys some really creative ideas for ways around our national security?
It's a great question, David. It's one of the things that thriller authors do deal with, is that you hope you're not giving bad guys ideas. But by the same token, if I'm giving bad guys ideas, they're really not as good as we think they are. I mean, if Al-Qaeda or some other organization needs to be, you know, if in Pyongyang, they're poring over the latest Brad Thor novel, they're not as bad as we think they are. But I did set one of my, couple of books ago, Use of Force, I opened with the Burning Man Festival in the desert, Black Rock City out in Nevada. And it ended up, because of what I did in there, it ended up, it went through, there was a federal review of the security situation because of the book. And they decided that what they'd seen in my book was very plausible and they wanted to tighten things up at Burning Man. So there have been instances where I have suggested things in the book that have gotten the attention of the government. And so if I'm helping in my own very minuscule, small way to make the nation a safer place through the stuff that I put in the books, then that's a good thing. That's icing on the cake. And as someone who cares more about being an American citizen than being an American novelist, that's just all bonus for me.
Well, I've got to say, I suspect at least that after The Lions of Lucerne, your first dramatic novel, that the Secret Service has probably taken some added protections should a president of the United States ever go skiing, to prevent a kidnapping. Quite, for those of you who haven't read it yet, it's quite a way to open a novel in this genre. Karen, let me turn back to you. You were an analyst for many years. And as you know, analytic writing in the intelligence community is its own specific art form. It is unlike any other style of writing, even though it has some similarities with journalism, but it's very crisp. It's very sparse. The whole idea is to not let a policymaker who may be making a life or death decision come away misunderstanding anything that you're saying about the intelligence reporting or about your assessment thereof. That does not make for interesting reading of an espionage novel. So how much of a challenge was it to adapt from that very crisp, very dry analytic writing style, trying to communicate as much as possible in just a few words, to writing something with dialogue, with emotions, and with if not a flowery style, at least a more entertaining style to read.
Yeah, it is an adjustment. You know, I mean, like you say, the style is very specific and it's really drilled into you to the point that, you know, a first sentence should look this way and then your second two sentences should look this way. And, you know, very different styles, very different objectives. And it did take some getting used to sort of having that creative license, I guess. But I think in overall, I would say it probably helped my fiction writing. I think one of the things that is sort of drilled into you as an analyst is you can't waste words. And, you know, policymakers have some real time constraints and you need to get to the point and you need to make them care about an issue and you need to make your argument compelling enough that they read your analysis to the end. And I think I did try to apply some of those principles to my novel writing as well, you know, trying to grab the reader's attention early and trying to make them care about your characters and trying to sort of write a book in a way that kind of keeps them just hopefully wanting to read one more chapter.
That's not normal, Karen. Most analysts, even if they can be creative, it's creative in the way that they attack a hard to solve problem or get at some intelligence gaps. But there are cases in history where even managers at the CIA tried to get analysts to write more creatively. One of the examples back from the 1980s I remember hearing about was when someone said, we really need to get policymakers to read in a different way about the Soviet Union. So he tried to create, I think he called it the Red Book. He tried to create a version of a PDB, if you will, that was from the Russian perspective. You know, if the Russians had a president's daily brief like we do, what would it say? And he told the analysts, run with it, have fun. And what he found is no one would do it. They were all so wed to the standard way of doing things that he had a hard time getting them to think outside the box and do that. You made the transition relatively seamlessly, even you know, working on this book while you were an analyst. Do you think that your colleagues have reacted to it by kind of scratching their heads and thinking, maybe I can do this too? And if not, what feedback have you received from your former colleagues?
You know, I would say by and large, it's been positive feedback, but we are in an interesting position. And Alma, I know you're in the same boat here, but finding that line between entertainment and, or maybe it's, you know, realism and accuracy. Like if they're, you want to write sort of the most realistic novel you can. And, but, you know, at the same time, I think what people think about the CIA from movies and television a lot of times is this very flashy high-tech organization. And CIA is, you know, extremely high-tech, but it's not really in a flashy way. And, you know, do you sort of, a lot of people work in cubicles and windowless vaults. And do you sort of write it kind of from that perspective? Or do you sort of just, do you jazz it up a little bit? And if you jazz it up a little bit, you might get some criticism from your colleagues for not being, you know, exactly true to form. But, you know, part of why people pick up a spy thriller is also to be entertained. So it's sort of finding that balance, I think.
Alma, you've got a potential TV series coming on this book, Red Widow. Who do you see other than the dashing Mark Rozelle, Larry Pfeiffer, and Michael Hayden? Who do you see as actors who could play some of the characters here, including the two lead women, very strong characters in their own right?
Wow. You know, so I tell people I'm really terrible at picking actors because I always think of ones that maybe aren't the most current ones, right? I'm a little older. I'm happy to say that that it is an active development with Fox, and we've just settled on a showrunner, but I'm not at liberty to release the name. And I was talking to the woman who's really running things. They made me an executive producer, but she's the one who really knows how to, I guess she's the executive producer. And so I guess we're a couple steps away from starting to think about casting, but early on they had asked me, who do you picture for the characters? And for Lindsay Duncan, it was really hard because Lindsay's a little on the younger side, but the other main female character is Teresa Warner, who's a slightly older and, you know, just like a kind of a blue blood. You run into this a little bit at the agency, you know, folks who, you know, came from Yale and, you know, have this, that kind of background. And I could really see Kate Blanchett. And they actually even brought the name up. they brought up the name of a really top actor to be one of the male leads. We haven't picked Larry's character yet. For people who don't know, when you read the book, you'll see there's a character by the name of Patrick Pfeiffer with very distinctive hair color. And that's because Larry and I actually go back a long way. And when I needed a character that was gonna be at the top of the echelon at CIA, maybe arguably the only character who always does the right thing, I thought of Larry. So yeah, but we haven't cast him yet, Larry. Maybe you can come up with some ideas for us there.
I gotta say, Alma, you weren't exactly subtle. The chief of staff to the director is someone named Pfeiffer, when Larry was the chief of staff to the director and named Pfeiffer. So maybe fiction has its boundaries there.
You know, that was the funnest thing about writing this book. I was finally free to sort of, you know, recognize some of my friends who over the years, you know, if you see them in the grocery store, sometimes you can't even, you know, say hello to them. So.
Yeah. Let me ask you about one of them. You dedicated the book to Tony Alcott. Tell us just a little bit about him and why you dedicated the book to him.
Well, I'm sure there's people in the audience today who know Tony, who unfortunately passed away a couple years ago. He and I overlapped a lot in our career, and Tony was one of the, you know, outstanding Russian experts for the intelligence community for many years. And he used to joke that I was following him around from job to job. He even wrote some like mystery crime stories in the 90s. He wrote some novels and they were set in Russia. He was a brilliant, brilliant man, like had the most nimblest intelligence I ever met. And so I was really thrilled to be able to make him the senior director for Russia affairs at the National Security Council in my book. So yep, thank you.
Yep. Brad, in your recent books, I hope I'm not giving too much away if I give a general setting. You've dealt a lot with Russia, with almost a resurgent Cold War feeling involving the Russians and their efforts to at least challenge NATO, if not destroy NATO, and try to go back to the Soviet Empire of old. But your other books have gone into many other areas, including terrorism. The world is always changing. And we just had the worldwide threats briefings to Congress after they took a year off last year. And we got to see them rack and stack the threats that the intelligence community assesses are the most grave to United States national security interests. And of course, the usual suspects were in there, such as North Korea, Iran, Russia, and some transnational issues like pandemics, terrorism, and cyber issues. But at the top of the list, and what seemed to be the first among equals and maybe beyond equals, was the threat from China. And I'm wondering whether Scott Harvath, in your mind, has some adventures to the Far East coming in future books.
I've dealt with China before, and particularly with the new book in June, I've been very interested. China declared itself a near Arctic state, which is this made up term. Only George Costanza could have come up with something better than we're a near Arctic state. I think it's 900 miles, their nearest settlement to the Arctic Circle. So I have been focused, particularly with NATO, I've been very concerned about a revanchist Russia trying to pick off some of our Baltic NATO members. I know that war game scenarios have been done where the Russians go after Latvia, Lithuania, or Estonia, and I think control of Gotland, then we're not going to be able to get ships in. I was fascinated to learn from a friend in the national security arena about the fact that railroad gauges change as we go from Germany and Poland and try to go through the Suwalki Gap. And so there's all these logistical concerns. And I really believe that politics are downstream of culture. So if I, because I've got a lot of fans in DC that are in the intel community, in the political arena, I know members of Congress read my books and all these kinds of things. So if I can find an entertaining way to point to the threats, almost as you were talking about the Red Book and things like this, a way to kind of wake up the policymakers to issues that we need to pay attention to. Again, we're seeing what's happening with Putin in Ukraine right as we're recording this. The Chinese are very, very important. And this idea of the Chinese trying to get a toehold anywhere they can to exert influence in the Arctic as the temperatures rise two times as fast as anywhere else on the planet. And the Chinese want to compete for those resources, not only those, but also the Northern Sea Route to make a polar silk route. They would love to do that and have Russia's permission to transit up there. So I think there's a lot of, I think as an American who is concerned more about national security than I am about selling books, when I can put these things together and draw attention to, hey, we need to be focused on the Arctic and China's ambitions there, as well as what's going on in the South China Sea, what's going on with Taiwan, all that kind of stuff. If I can do that in an entertaining way that maybe even a politician, significant other, reads this book and says, hey, are you paying attention to this? I think I've done a good job as a responsible member of our republic.
Karen, what advice would you give to someone who is interested in getting started and has that problem thinking they can't do it? Because you were in a job, you were doing very well in that job, and yet you decided to take a step away from it and do something entirely different. What advice would you give somebody in your shoes several years ago?
Yeah, I think just to go for it. And, you know, I don't know that there's ever necessarily going to be a right time to try to write a novel. But I think just, you know, finding those bits of time whenever you can, and also just putting words on paper. I think I probably write the world's worst first drafts, and they're not things that I would ever want to share with anybody. But, you can't edit a blank page. So I think just getting some words down on paper, especially if you feel like you're stuck, just kind of get something down and keep going. And by the time you get to the end, you have a whole novel that you can go back and edit. So I think just do it.
Alma, first drafts versus finished drafts. When you started Red Widow, did you already have the entire plot? And I'm not going to say much more than that because it's amazing. But did you have the entire plot in mind, sketched out, or did you develop part of it while writing?
You know, I'd gotten advice a long time ago from Jeff Deaver. He really plots very heavily in an outline. And so when it comes time to write the book, he says, he may have an outline that's like 90 pages, and he's just sticking the dialogue in at that point to make his finished book. So, you know, I really took it to heart that I was going to need to plot this out. But I think, and I'd be curious to hear what Brad and Karen do too, that there's, you know, I think the book's going to go a certain way, and at a certain point in revision, I find that things have to change, things have to be added. With this particular book, if you read it, you'll see there's two point of view characters, and this is kind of a writery geeky thing, but the question of where the second point of view character would come in, because this huge revelation comes when that second point of view character comes in. Right. And traditionally, you want to hold that as long as you can, because it, you know, kind of changes the story. But I knew that that point of view voice was so dynamic and so strong, I kept fighting to bring it in earlier. And every time it moved, the hundreds of little details behind it all had to be changed. It was the world's most intricate Jenga puzzle. And I just had to do that over and over and over again. And I thought I'd never get it right, but I think we got it right at the end.
I think so too. Let's kick that quickly to both of you, Brad and Karen, if you could follow up on that. What is it in the process of actually writing the book you already have completely sketched out? And what is it that you do allow to develop, or even if ideas come to you, do you work them in? Brad, you first.
So first of all, it is just a thrill for me to listen to Karen and Alma talk about the process. It's nothing a writer geeks out over more than being with other writers and learning that they're not alone, that the struggles that they go through, crummy first drafts and all that kind of stuff, it's not unique to any individual writer. I'm a big believer in what Robert Frost said, which is no surprise in the writer, no surprise in the reader, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. So unlike Alma, I don't outline, and it's much to my detriment. I am a seat of the pants. It reveals itself to me. I joke that when I come home at night, my wife can tell if it's a red wine night or a bourbon night by the expression on my face, because I've painted myself into a corner and I don't have an outline. So I don't know what happens tomorrow. And she always says, you always figure it out. You've done 21 books. You'll figure this one out. But I think it makes my job harder. So a lot of respect to Alma and Jeff Deaver for outlining, and to Karen too, if she's an outliner. I don't know.
Karen, where are you on this spectrum?
I am an outliner, and you know, I wonder if that, you know, DI training and having to write analytic products from the CIA sort of doesn't play into that, because I don't think I could really approach it without sort of knowing kind of where I was going. And that said, I think things do change, but yeah, I need that outline.
Yeah. Karen, How do you keep up on things? What are you reading? How are you generating ideas for your Brad Thor-like pace of writing?
You know, I think just a little bit of everything. And I really do like reading the news and just a little bit of everything.
Okay. Alma, where do you find inspiration and what are you reading?
Well, I'm actually still a consultant. I have confidential clients, both in government and in the private sector. And I have to stay on top of news. Primarily, I have to stay on top of technology news. So part of me wonders if I should be writing techno thrillers, you know, but that keeps you also on what's happening geopolitically. So yeah, just an incredible amount of news I have to read every day.
Yeah. Brad, what are you reading the most these days? And is that how you keep up on some of the amazing ideas you put in your books?
Well, one of the things I try very hard and I've been successful at is not siloing myself. I don't go to places that reinforce my worldview or my political opinions or anything else. I want to be challenged in my beliefs. So I've been reading so much about the Arctic Circle over the last year, year and a half. So I've been going everywhere, even Russian sites, because I want to see the Russian take on things. I've been reading sites that I know are funded by the CCP out of Beijing. So I want everything, and I want to develop my own opinion, which not only I think makes me a better writer, but makes me a better citizen, if I'm not just staying in a comfort zone in an echo chamber.
Got it. Let me bring in a question from Brian Solemn, who used to work in the White House Situation Room and is working on a fiction novel of his own. He asks, what is the easiest and the hardest part of the fiction writing process for each of you? And I have my own ideas based on having read all of your books, what it is for each of you that maybe you worked on the most, but your self-assessment, Karen, what was easiest for you in writing a novel and what was hardest?
Ooh. You know, I think...
This is like therapy.
That's a tough one to answer.
Yeah. Tell me about your mother.
I think for me, sort of coming up with just a really compelling story idea is sort of something that's very difficult. But I think it's also something that, you know, I have sort of figured out that it doesn't have to be as difficult as I'm making it out to be. And I think I've sort of tried to think about my experiences at the CIA and just try to think what were some sort of random thoughts and fears that I had when I was working there. And that has actually sort of led me to, I think, kind of my best story ideas. And just as an example, my book, You Can Run, that comes out this summer, it is about a CIA analyst who's responsible for vetting new CIA sources. And she's also a mom to a baby boy. And one day when she's just about to get started kind of digging into the CIA's hottest new recruit, she gets a call and the voice on the other end of the line says, we have your son. And so to get her son back, she has to do something that she never would have thought she'd do. And that idea sort of came, I remember just this thought I had when I was walking into Langley one day after dropping my baby off at daycare. And just this thought that, you know, no amount of money, no blackmail would ever make me betray my country. But, you know, what if something happened to my family? What if my family was in danger? And that could potentially be a game changer. So I think those story ideas are sort of falls both ways, I guess.
Yeah. Alma, what did you find easy or hard, either about writing fiction in general or more specifically when writing Red Widow?
Well, the funny thing is comparatively, Red Widow was easy to write. I mean, if you look at my last two books, one was on the Donner Party and then the Titanic. And I get the question all the time, how do you do your historical research? Because the books require so much research. The Titanic alone, 2,300 people I had to look at, let alone the minute by minute, you know. But I tell people, you know, for me, and I'm sure Karen feels the same way, when you've been an analyst and you're used to, you know, compiling so much information and organizing thoughts and, you know, all that, it's nothing, you know, you get used to that. But for Red Widow, it was something I had already been doing for 30 years. So as I was developing the story, you know, at every plot point, I knew what the options were, you know, I didn't have to really fight it out. So for me, that part was all easy. What I find so hard is actually developing the protagonist, because the protagonist, generally, you can't, you know, I love villains. I love bad people. And if you're going to have a series, you have to have a recurring character that people feel good about, who they can root for, et cetera, et cetera. And I find it so hard to come up with someone who who is like that, that I just don't find hopelessly dull.
Brad, you actually were brought in by the Department of Homeland Security Red Cell to help them think through some ideas having to do with potential threats. I'm wondering, without giving away anything you're not allowed to, what can you share with us about what it felt like to give back in that way after writing in this world for so long?
It's really funny. When I tell the story, it was like something out of a movie. I was living in Utah at the time in Park City and hiking in the mountains in a place my cell phone had never worked. And then the cell phone worked. And I got this call asking me if I would come to DC and be part of this. It is a think tank for the Department of Homeland Security. Michael Bay, the director of the Transformers movies, was in there. My dear friend and novelist, Brad Meltzer. And I think for me, it was one of the most forward-thinking government programs established after 9/11, which is before the 9/11 Commission had even been impaneled, they said, this happened because of a failure of imagination on our part. So how do we stay 3, 4, 5, 6 steps ahead of the bad guys? Well, instead of bringing people together inside the Beltway, let's reach outside the Beltway and bring in these creative people who are not necessarily government folks, but who are creative thinkers. And that to me is the son of a United States Marine, to be asked to serve my country, not by picking up a rifle, but by using the gray matter between my ears in talent that I was so incredibly fortunate to be given by God, that for me was a big deal to serve the country that way. So that is fun. And I did what I do in my novels all the time. And the two best pieces of first fan mail I got came from two separate ends of the political spectrum. I got something from a Carter administration cabinet member that said, Brad Thor captures the meanness and vindictiveness of insider politics in Washington like nobody else. And then another person from the other side of the political spectrum that said, this guy nails the threats from our enemies better than any Washington, D.C. think tank. So to be able to contribute somehow to the national security, maybe not policymaking, but just discussion and things people are thinking about, it's incredibly humbling for me.
We've talked a bit about CIA because of Karen's background and Alma's. And Brad, some of your characters revolve in and around the CIA. But Alma, you've also worked at the National Security Agency. What do you think, Alma? Is this an idea for a new book?
On one hand, I think it would be fascinating because, you know, 2/3 of my career were spent with NSA. And NSA is a really interesting place to work. Of course, highly technical. And that's the thing. You know, the things that the intelligence community protects the most are sources and methods. And NSA has some incredibly important, complex, surprising sources and methods. And it's a story that probably deserves to be told. The people who work there, Larry can attest to this, the general can attest to this, you know, are uniquely gifted people who give their lives in the service of the American people. Having said that, I think it'd be a really hard book to write and make it through the pre-publication process. But if they're willing to work with me, I'll work with them.
Let me broaden the question out to you, Karen. You've written about the CIA primarily now twice and the FBI primarily once. What other setting, whether inside the national security community or outside, would you be interested in exploring?
You know, the intelligence community is so big and varied that there really are, you know, a lot of options there and a lot of kind of smaller agencies and people doing important work that, you know, don't really get any recognition. So I think that there are definitely other possibilities out there. That said, I feel like CIA is what I know the best and I sort of want to stick to that, I think.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. A special thank you this week to the Hayden Center and the Schar School at George Mason University. Please share the podcast, rate the podcast, share the podcast on social media, and don't forget to check out Lawfare merchandise at the Lawfare store. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.